From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. President Trump tweeted this morning that he's chosen CNBC commentator Larry Kudlow to be his top economic advisor, and that the country will see years of great economic and financial success with low taxes and fair trade. Speaking yesterday at a Boeing plant in St. Louis, the president also promised more tax cuts.
And we're now going for a phase two. We're actually going for a phase two, which will help, in addition to the middle class, will help companies, and it's going to be something, I think, very special. Kevin Brady's working on it.
Joining us now is Ali Velshi, MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent and co-host of Velshi and Rule. Hi, Ali.
Hey, Jeremy.
Are we going to see a second round of tax cuts?
Well, we don't have any details at the moment, but it looks like, as Donald Trump said, he and the House Ways and Means Committee Chairman Brady are signaling something that's going to be coming up. Brady had said that the new changes, if there are any, are going to be related to extending the individual tax cuts. As you know, those are slated to expire in 2025,
right.
And that's some of what they're talking about.
And the reason that they slated those to expire in 2025 was to keep the cost down on
Correct.
The tax cut package. So if they were to expend them, make them permanent, it would obviously make it more expensive.
That is correct. So it might be a little bit of sleight of hand. The Republicans have made no secret of the fact that they expect and are banking on the fact that the individual tax cuts don't expire in 2025. It's part of how they sold it, because a lot of people were saying, wait a second, you've got these permanent tax cuts for corporations,
right.
but only temporary tax cuts for individuals. And a lot of Republicans said, no, don't worry, we'll make them permanent tax cuts for individuals.
Okay, so what about Larry Kudlow, the CNBC commentator? He's replacing the outgoing director of the National Economic Council, Gary Cohn, who resigned last week after disagreeing with the president's plans for tariffs on imported steel and aluminum. But it turns out Kudlow has not been a big fan of the tariffs either. He called them a bad omen on CNBC earlier this month.
In the Reagan years, we used to call the free traders the white hats and the protectionists the black hats. Mm-hmm. The black hats won this time around. I'm very sorry, as it will damage the economy to some extent.
Is Kudlow going to have to change his tune on tariffs?
Well, it's interesting because the president said Kudlow has come around to the president's way of thinking. And Kudlow said the president is more nuanced than the media gives him credit for being. But, I mean, I've never met a bigger free trader than Larry Kudlow. Kudlow's had on the record comments about this for decades, right? He worked in the Reagan White House. He was the chief economist for Bear Stearns. He is about as free trade a guy as you've ever met. So what he's saying now is that you can use tariffs in order to get better free trade, get better deals, to use them as negotiating points when, renegotiating deals. It's not exactly how Donald Trump's been conducting himself, and the steel tariffs have not really matched that. So I don't know whether Kudlow's changing his tune or they're both sort of trying to make it look like they think more like each other than they do.
Meanwhile, Ali, in the Senate yesterday, a bipartisan vote to pass a bill that would relax some banking regulations that were part of the Dodd-Frank financial reform bill, which was put in place after
Yep.
the financial crisis to prevent future financial crises. What does this bill do?
Well, a number of Democrats voted with Republicans to pass this bill, but, Elizabeth Warren is still very much against it. Part of what this bill does is it raises the limit from $50 billion to $250 billion in assets that would be the threshold for banks to be designated as systemically important financial institutions. So, in other words, a bank can be much bigger before it is subject to the strictest scrutiny by federal authorities. That worries some people because if you think about Countrywide, which was, it sort of triggered the subprime mortgage crisis. Countrywide was $221 billion at the time, so it would then not be subject to the most strict of regulation. So that's part of what it is. Companies like American Express, KeyCorp, BB&T would be freed from many of the compliance costs. The way to think about this bill is it's a modernization of Dodd-Frank, which a lot of people, including Barney Frank, thought needed to be modernized. But a lot of Democrats are saying it's gone too far.
And some people look at the Senate doing this and say, did we learn nothing from the financial crisis, the biggest one since the Great Depression?
Yeah, I mean, it is 10 years today from the failing of Bear Stearns.
Right.
And, one thing that we've learned is that the big banks controlled a very, very big part of financial markets and the economy. And actually, the big banks today control more of it than they did back then. So, you'll talk to some people and they say what happened in 2008, 2009 could never happen again. But there are a lot of people who say, actually, it possibly can. And Elizabeth Warren and others are of the group who say, if you don't regulate these companies properly, they won't regulate themselves. They'll take bigger risks and affect the economy.
It's Ali Velshi, MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent and co-host of Velshi and Rule. Ali, thanks as always.
Thank you.
Well, let's turn now to the newspaper industry and the media giant Tronc, short for Tribune Online Content, which owns prominent papers like the Chicago Tribune, the Baltimore Sun, and for now, the Los Angeles Times. Tronc's management of the LA Times has been controversial. The executive hired to run it, Ross Levinson, was a defendant in two sexual harassment lawsuits. Questions have also been raised about some of his earlier business practices. But when Tronc announced the sale of the LA Times, they also quietly cleared Levinson of any wrongdoing. He's now leading efforts to reshape digital content for newspapers serving tens of millions of readers, and there are questions. NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik has followed Levinson's career closely. And David, in fact, you broke the story of his alleged misconduct. What was he accused of, and how did Tronc respond?
So as you mentioned, the most serious things came up in two separate lawsuits when he worked at two separate places, the early search engine Alta Vista and when he worked for Fox as an executive there. In both cases, he wasn't accused of quid pro quo kind of demands or things like Harvey Weinstein, but he had been accused of creating, by the accuser's account, kind of frat house atmospheres, tolerating certain kind of behavior. And in his own sworn testimony in one of those cases, he talked about having rated the hotness of some of his female employees, wondering aloud whether one of them was sleeping with one of the coworkers, whether one of them worked on the side as a stripper. These was seen as somewhat damning. Both of these cases were settled by his employers for private amounts. There were other lesser incidents in which he was accused of some things that made colleagues uncomfortable as well.
Well, tell us more about his career. You know, reputation is one thing, and it's important to newspapers and these accusations. But tell us where he went and what he did.
Well, so he's worked at a lot of places in media, particularly digital media, held sort of in some ways a sparkling resume. He was at Fox when he encouraged Rupert Murdoch to invest in or take over MySpace and explore questions of Facebook as well. That was seen as a jewel of an acquisition. It sort of collapsed and failed as a venture under News Corp to be anything like the rival of Facebook that it was seen as being. But he was given credit for doing that and not really blamed for its failure. He later went on to be an investor in a couple of incarnations, went on to be a top executive at Yahoo and at a brief point as its acting CEO, all along seen as a consummate salesman, a hail fellow well met, a guy who liked to do business, have a good time, and often found to be very charming in seeking to strike deals. I can't say there are a lot of things that you would point with as huge successes under him, but he's been at a lot of interesting places at a lot of times.
Well, also big parties, yachts, things like that. They were, you know, supposed to court advertisers. One could say, so what?
Yeah. So one of the things in reporting on his past was the extent to which he saw being involved in major parties thrown by at the expense of his employers being a way to do business and draw in advertisers. And in a sense, so what's a fair question? A lot of people do this in the media, particularly in the Hollywood media where he certainly had ties. Some of these parties were events at which people had great discomfort. There was one party held by – he was the head of an investment group that held the Billboard, the music publication. He was described by two witnesses to me as how to say this, having sort of a sexualized contact, his hands ranging over her body in the view of peers and colleagues and people who worked for him in a way that people objected to in the moment. At another party held when he was at Yahoo off the coast of Cannes on a yacht, an executive for a digital media company said she decided that she didn't want to be there to do business and watching men sort of look at women in flimsy outfits. Mm-hmm. And she sort of decamped and said, let's do business during regular business hours. That is, she felt that was an inappropriate place to be trying to do business. And I think we're seeing people look very closely at those kinds of questions right now.
Well, but there are other questions about money. Levinson's relationship also with James Heckman. You say their careers follow one another like a shadow.
Yeah, James Heckman, a serial digital media entrepreneur in call it around 2000 and I want to say 5 or 6. Levinson had Fox acquire one of Heckman's firms for a significant amount of money, and they stayed in very close contact after that. Heckman worked for Levinson for a while at Fox, and he continued on there. He then urged Yahoo when Levinson was an executive there. Levinson urged Yahoo to acquire another firm that they founded together. Levinson was said to drop any financial interest he had in the transaction. It went through. And some years later, I was able to show, and that they both confirmed, that Heckman cut a private check for Levinson. Questions raised in some ways by some of their colleagues. Does that payment represent somehow a benefit for Levinson for that transaction? Levinson says no, it was just a payment of gratitude for their collegiality over the years. More recently, they founded a new startup that even while Levinson was a $600,000 a year consultant to Tronc, James Heckman tried to get Tronc to make a major investment in that company. Again, colleagues of Levinson at Tronc wondering whether there was some self-interest driving that as well.
We got a couple seconds here, but now journalists at the LA Times are worried that Tronc executives are doing things in their own interest as opposed to journalism. In the few seconds we have, that seems to be the issue.
Well, that's certainly related to the questions raised by the question of the investment of Tronc in their startup. Tronc says they have no intention of doing business. But if you look at the kinds of content plans that we've written about, it seems related to their startup.
We'll pick it up again. David
Folkenflik. Kind of startup they did.
David Folkenflik, thank you. The Democrat Conor Lamb is the apparent winner of Pennsylvania's special House election, a razor-thin victory over the Republican Rick Saccone in this very red district. Part of Lamb's appeal was that he was willing to stray from the Democratic Party line, but also his military record. And as a former Marine, he'll join a small group in Congress. Just 19% of House lawmakers are vets. It's something like that in the Senate. Compare that to the 60s and 70s, when more than 75% of both chambers of Congress were former service members. Our next guest says this is a problem. Rai Barkat is an Iraq War veteran, a former Marine captain, and co-founder of the group With Honor, a political action committee that's trying to get post-9/11 veterans of both parties elected to office. Today it announced its second round of endorsements, 4 Republicans and 5 Democrats. Rai joins us now. Welcome.
Thanks so much.
And I know you weren't involved in Conor Lamb's campaign, although a Democrat and a veteran was, a fellow former Marine, Congressman Seth Moulton from Massachusetts. He was very much involved in that election. Your reaction, though, when you saw the win?
Oh, yeah. A thrilling win for next-generation veterans who are able to put principles before politics. Yeah. And, you know, I served in the Marine Corps with Seth Moulton, and I think very highly of what he's doing. And with Honor.org, we're trying to create and help get elected people like Seth and Connor from both parties who take a pledge, which is to serve with integrity, civility, and courage, including the courage to work across the aisles, which is, you know, so essentially important because of the level of dysfunction and polarization in Congress.
Well, in addition to asking them to have the courage, you are requiring of them that they have action, that they actually will give back to charity contributions from sources that taint their integrity, that meet with someone from an opposing party one-on-one at least once a month, and join with colleagues on both sides of the aisle on at least one piece of major legislation every year. Is that possible? I mean, you're asking them to do something that nobody's done.
It's so essential, and it used to happen. You know, when Congress had much higher representation of veterans, 70%, now it's below 20%. Congress was also a more trusted institution, and frankly, the veterans worked across party lines in better ways. You know, when I served in the Marine Corps, I didn't know the party affiliation of most of the people that I served with. It didn't matter. You know, we were serving a mission that was larger than ourselves. We've got some really interesting research that we've done with the West Point professor of political science that actually shows that veterans historically, as a group, they functioned in a more bipartisan and cross-partisan way in Congress over the last 50 years.
Well, there are actually a lot more veterans back then, years ago, because, of course, there was a draft and more people were required to serve. Now we don't have that. Fewer veterans, but also fewer Republican veterans we're seeing. 2/3 of vet candidates this year are Democrats. How do you change that?
You know, the key factor in the decline in veterans is actually not the decline of vets in the population. If you ask post-9/11 veterans that are currently serving in Congress, it's the costs that have gone up in such absurd and astronomical ways.
You mean to run? You know,
to run, yeah. I mean, and that's both the cost of these elections, which have gone up 5x in 20 years, but also, frankly, the personal costs. You know, many of these individuals that are running, it's now a full-time job for a year just to run, to make that sacrifice. And of the candidates that we're supporting, they're post-9/11 veterans, so most of them are under the age of 45. They're not independently wealthy. They don't have access to, you know, affluent networks oftentimes, and it's an incredible barrier. So what withhonor.org is doing is we're actually lowering those barriers to entry by providing really significant support independently to campaigns and doing that early when it matters most.
So you're trying to raise money, trying to get more candidates out there. We'll link listeners to the list of the candidates that you're endorsing today. But what happens when you get a Republican and a Democrat running for the same race? They're both veterans.
Yeah, sometimes we see this. If there's a race where you have a Republican and a Democrat who meet the criteria of With Honor and are willing to sign the pledge, potentially we'll endorse both candidates in the primaries. And then if both advance through the primaries, we'll step out and say, congratulations, district, you've got a high class problem of a principled next generation veteran who is committed to be part of this cross-partisan coalition and get things done in Congress.
What do you say to people, though, who are worried that these are, after all, veterans of the military? There's already $700 billion being spent on defense. There are wars being waged with no end. What do you say to those who worry that this might mean more, you know, military spending and more military action?
Very important question. You know, there's really cutting-edge political science from a professor that I actually used to work for as an undergraduate 15 years ago, Professor Richard Cohn, who's on our advisory board, and Professor Peter Fever at Duke and UNC. And what these professors have looked at is how veterans make national security decisions across U.S. history. And what they found is that actually veterans as a group, they have had a higher propensity to not commit force to solve national security problems immediately. They have been more restrained. Why? Because many of them have actually seen the scourge of war and the challenges of solving problems with a blunt instrument of force. And I think that's another reason why it's so very important to get people who have actually served something larger than themselves.
Ray Barkat, again, Iraq War veteran, former Marine captain, and co-founder of the group With Honor, the new political action committee trying to get post-9/11 vets of both parties into office. Rye, thank you.
Thanks so much.
Well, a Texas district attorney is launching an investigation into the death of that French bulldog that died on a United Airlines flight. The dog's owner says she was told by a flight attendant to store the dog in an overhead bin. United says it'll issue special bag tags for animal carriers in response to the incident. Meanwhile, airlines are dealing with another problem, a shortage of pilots. There's fierce competition for cockpit crews, and that's most apparent at the regional airlines. Tom Bonsi from the Northwest News Network reports from Washington State on how the regional airlines are competing with each other for new recruits.
Welcome to the show.
The airlines are hungry as the organizers of the Northwest Aviation Career Forum have ever seen.
And I hope everybody that's here looking for a job finds one today.
Recruiters from nearly a dozen regional airlines have come to this career fair to meet aspiring pilots and students. Info tables for airlines, flight schools, and industry groups line the perimeter of a cavernous fairgrounds hall. Job seekers could even get an on-the-spot initial interview. Minnesota-based Compass Airlines sent recruiter Emmy Nguyen. She says the airline, which operates as Delta Connection or American Eagle, is looking to hire 400 new pilots this year.
My personal goal is as many as we can get, minimum at 400, because our attrition is very high as well. So we lose about 20 to 30 to 35, sometimes 40 pilots to the major airline each month.
That's because the major airlines are experiencing a wave of retirements. They backfill by plucking pilots from regional carriers. Other factors in play here. The whole sector is growing. Then there's the tough work schedules pilots endure and extensive training requirements. Nguyen says the regional airlines have increased what used to be low starting pay for pilots by quite a bit because of the competition. Now come signing and retention bonuses.
Right now we have $17,500 for sign-on bonus. And I know you're looking at me like you're shocked, but you'll be surprised. There's so many other regional airlines out there who are offering way more than we do.
Seattle-based Horizon Air and its big sister, Alaska Airlines, had a huge recruiting presence at this career fair. VP for Flight Operations John Hornibrook says Horizon alone wants to hire more than 300 pilots this year. The regional carrier's flight schedule was hit hard by a pilot shortage last year.
Right now, we're almost back to where we're supposed to be. We've really righted the ship. We were able to right the ship pretty fast.
Hornibrook says he's never seen the industry be this busy in his 30 years. He's now working on building a long-term pilot pipeline with flight schools to feed his company. U.S. Army chopper pilot Matt Moss is giving Horizon a good look, along with several of its competitors. Moss realizes he's leaving the service at a good time. Still, he says he was taken aback by the starting pay.
For me, it will be a pay cut to go to the regionals, about a half of what I make right now in the military. So it's going to be hard those first couple of years to get through that. And I really probably don't have any room to complain because this pay has been adjusted way up because of this situation compared to what it was just a couple of years ago.
18-year-old high school senior Chase Van Dyke of Enumclaw, Washington, also wants to be a pilot. He's applied to get an aviation degree and airline pilot training at Central Washington University. It's one of the cheaper options in the Pacific Northwest, but still pricey. Van Dyke faces a total cost, including many hours of flight time, of around $100,000. But remember how hungry those airlines are? Van Dyke noticed they're now reimbursing partial tuition or giving stipends to promising students who commit to flying for that airline after earning their wings.
A big company like Alaska, for example, that's the one I would like to work with. I'd love to work with them. If they would pay for me to go to school, I would just love that.
And they might.
Yeah, it would just be a great help.
Public and private flight schools are expanding enrollment capacity, but what goes around comes around. Some of them are having trouble holding on to faculty, instructors, and mechanics, given the competitive labor market. Andy McIrvin directs flight operations for the Central Washington University Department of Aviation.
The airlines are almost eating their young because if you take away all the industry trainers, you're not going to have anybody to train the next group of people coming through.
Airlines are also aggressively recruiting business pilots from corporate flight departments and charter aircraft fleets. Bottom line, it's a great time to be a pilot. For Here and Now, I'm Tom Bonson.
The stunning images out of yesterday's student walkout marking the month since the Parkland school shooting was the number of kids of color from cities which have seen young people gunned down for years without the kind of outrage we're seeing now. Like Alex King. He's a senior at Chicago's North Lawndale College Prep High School. Alex, you say when you saw the horrific mass shooting in Parkland, you had tremendous sympathy for those kids.
Yes, I had a lot of sympathy for the kids because I know how it feels to lose someone. It automatically hurt me as well as it hurt the Parkland students because no one's life should be lost, especially in a place, an environment where you think that you are the safest in school.
Well, but you're also talking about your nephew, Deshaun Moore, who was sitting on his porch in 2017 when he was killed in a drive-by. So sorry for your loss.
Thank you.
Yeah. Look, you've also said that maybe this will draw more attention to Chicago. Your thoughts on, you know, the outrage over these school shootings and what's been going on in Chicago for years?
Well, what's been going on in Chicago for years is just shootings after shootings after shootings. It's really not school shootings that are happening in Chicago, but still, gun violence is gun violence. That weekend of the Parkland, Florida shooting, 6 were killed and 22 were wounded in Chicago.
In shootings, yeah. What would you want to see happen? Because, you know, gun rights advocates point to Chicago as a reason not to have gun control because Chicago has so much and there's still violence. But then I'm sure, as you also well know, most of the guns in Chicago come from out of state.
It's really not about the gun control, the gun policy at this point, because just like you said, Chicago is good with that. But what is the point of that when we can go to Indiana and purchase a gun within 30 minutes?
Yeah.
What we are really calling for is the playing fields to be leveled out, like state to state.
You all yesterday had red tape across your mouths. What were you, in not speaking, what were you saying?
You know, when someone dies and the police identify that out on the streets, they put red tape around the neighborhood.
Mm.
So we put red tape around our mouths to show that we had to be silent about it, even though we weren't trying to be silent about it. We just weren't being heard.
Do you hope now, have you talked to any of the Parkland kids? You're sort of emerging as a voice.
Yes. I actually took a trip down to Florida. I actually already have talked to some of the Parkland kids.
What'd you talk about?
We talked about how our pain has made us like family. Our pain is what brought us together. Our trauma is what brought us together. And how this isn't a color thing. This isn't a social status thing. This isn't a division between anything, because trauma is nationwide, pain is nationwide, gun violence is nationwide.
Alex King, who's a high school senior at Chicago's North Lawndale College Prep, thank you so much.
Thank you.
This week, we saw the firing of Secretary of State Rex Tillerson, the second top White House official to either resign or be fired this month, and many are wondering if there may soon be more. But tension has long played a role in the relationship between a president and his Secretary of State. For a look back at that, we're joined by Joanne Freeman and Brian Ballow, historians and co-hosts of the weekly podcast Backstory. Welcome back.
Thanks.
Hey, good to be
us.
Here.
And I can't believe that there are so many examples, and we're going to get to them, of secretaries of state who didn't really work out for the president. But let's go back to the early days and just talk about the role, first of all. Joanne, the first secretary of state was Thomas Jefferson. What was the job like back then?
Well, it was indeed Thomas Jefferson. And the interesting thing about this job is it wasn't entirely clear precisely what the job would be. I mean, now we assume Secretary of State equals foreign affairs. Mm-hmm. But Jefferson, who was very excited in 1790 at being offered the job, he described it as the whole domestic administration, war and finance excepted.
Hmm.
So he pretty much thought, well, that's it. It's me.
Hey, Joanne, how did Alexander Hamilton feel about that?
Yeah, that was a big problem. Hamilton thought he was prime minister. This is a setup for bad, bad things to happen.
Okay, so what about early disputes between the president and secretary of state?
Well, so there are two sort of cabinet kerfuffles. The first one is actually our second president, and that's John Adams. Mm-hmm. His party's divided. His secretary of state, Timothy Pickering, is on the non-Adams part of his party. And in time, Adams just loses faith and distrusts the Secretary of State and demands his resignation. Interestingly, in this case, Timothy Pickering won't resign.
Mm.
He wants to stick around and do as much as he can do before his party's booted out. So in that case, Adams is forced to just fire him, which he does. Prominent case number two happens under Andrew Jackson. And in that case, it happens that Jackson's Secretary of War, John Eaton, his wife, Margaret or Peggy Eaton, is ostracized or shunned by the wives of other cabinet members. This enrages Jackson, whose own wife was not treated really well during his election. And so this becomes an enormous fuss, but it's not purely personal, because the head of the anti-Peggy Eaton campaign is Floride Calhoun. And again, divided party, the Calhoun people are kind of they're certainly not always friendly to Jackson. So again, Jackson doesn't really fully trust the motives of the people in his cabinet. And Martin Van Buren, who's the Secretary of State, resigns because he's a nice guy and he got along with Jackson, and he did it mostly to give Jackson an excuse to ask everybody else to resign, which is precisely what happened. Hmm. So the cabinet resigns.
So now it makes me wonder if President Trump and Rex Tillerson have been looking back at this history and they're just, they know it's happened before and they're doing the same thing.
But, you know, there's a one big, big difference, though, and that is the loyalty that's being talked about in this early period. It's not loyalty to the president specifically. These problems are happening because there's questions about loyalty to an administration's policies or agenda rather than just to the president.
Brian, let's jump ahead to the early 1900s and Secretary of State William Jennings Bryan. He was secretary under Woodrow Wilson. What was his impact?
Well, he is perhaps one of the few resignations based on principle. So he is very much remembered for his departure. It was very much his own doing. And he resigned basically because Wilson, in his opinion, would not enforce neutrality on both the British and the Germans. He said, if we let American citizens travel on these ships in an era of submarine warfare, something bad is going to happen and it's going to lead to war. And of course, that's exactly what happened when the Lusitania was sunk, and it did lead to war. So Bryan said, I will not be a part of this. Bryan had built his reputation as a diplomat by advocating for a kind of strict neutrality. And it's pretty well accepted that Wilson tilted towards the British increasingly as the European conflict went on.
Then take us to the 80s and Alexander Haig, who served for about a year and a half before he was forced to resign by President Reagan.
Alexander Haig was let's just say, it an outsized personality. Haig, like, got in trouble almost immediately by proclaiming that he was the vicar of foreign policy. That didn't really ingratiate him with the other foreign policy people. But as with the case of the folks Joanne was talking about, there were some deep-seated tensions that really did have to do with policy. Haig was very much a product of the Nixon-Kissinger establishment foreign policy, and Haig was working for Ronald Reagan, and the folks around Reagan, they saw themselves as disruptors, if you will, when it came to foreign policy. So there was a lot of substantive conflict between those two sides. At any rate, like almost every Secretary of State, and I want to emphasize this, Jeremy, because folks are always kind of threatening to resign. That's their big trump card, if you will. Well, Haig was always threatening to resign, and he was so convincing one day that he actually convinced Reagan that he had resigned. So Reagan went out and offered the job to George Shultz. Mm. The only problem was that Haig didn't think that he had resigned. So Shultz was in the very unenviable position of having to call Al Haig and say, Al, you know, you really have resigned. I really am going to be the new Secretary of State. And it ultimately took several phone calls and a call from Ronald Reagan to say, yes, you have resigned and I've accepted it.
See, now that sounds very familiar after the last couple of days.
You know,
the phone call coming after the announcement has been made about being fired.
But you see, Jeremy, I mean, we make so much of who left whom. And in most of these instances, like any bad relationship, it kind of takes two to break up.
It's time for a divorce.
Exactly. Exactly. And I do think we have to think about the limited tools that secretaries of state have at their disposal. And perhaps the most powerful one, especially in the 20th century, given all the publicity, is that threat to resign, all the publicity that goes with it. And really, most presidents have tried to avoid that one way or another. We happen to have a president who's quite different in the way he feels.
But, you know, one reason why that threat is so powerful these days is because the Secretary of State has such a public presence in a way that a lot of other cabinet members don't. So if that person steps forward and says they're going to resign or objects or say, calls the president a name, for example, that's something that Americans notice. So that is an extra added bonus tool of the Secretary of State.
There's one more example I want to talk about, and that is Jimmy Carter, who requested resignations from his entire cabinet. What happened there?
Well, this reminds me of the example that Joanne was just talking about. Carter had just given his speech about a crisis in confidence, labeled the, quote, malaise speech, even though Carter never used the word. And the Carter administration was in very bad shape. And he said, you know, we're going to reboot. I'm asking for the resignation of every cabinet member and a lot more presidential appointees. And everyone dutifully, you know, on paper said they were going to resign. Now, the whole foreign policy team was kept in place. But in fact, Carter accepted the resignation of, you know, a number of cabinet secretaries, one of them being the Secretary of the Treasury. Carter thought that this would show that, you know, he was turning over a new leaf, a new beginning. It would show energy. Well, just the opposite, because of what we were talking about, Jeremy. It was seen as a weakness. It was a disaster. And I actually think that's one of the reasons that presidents have been slow to ask for resignations or to fire people.
I think that that point that Brian just made is certainly true, and that's true over the long haul, which is it's not always a wise thing to fire cabinet members. Even John Adams, all the way back to the second president, his firing his Secretary of State does not do his reputation any favors. So if you look in the long view of history, I suppose there are lessons that presidents can take away based on how you should eliminate cabinet members.
See, John Adams' reputation, to me at this point, is the way that Paul Giamatti played him in the HBO
yes.
series, John Adams, which makes him look like not the nicest guy, kind of brilliant, but also, you know, he's got some reputation
edgy.
Issues.
Yeah, edgy. He was edgy.
Joanne Freeman and Brian Ballo, historians and co-hosts of the weekly podcast Backstory. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Have you always wanted to make bread, but you don't have time for all the kneading and rising and not to mention growing something like a biology experiment to get it started, and frankly, you're frightened? Well, do we have a segment for you and an idea, quick bread. Here in our resident chef, Kathy Gunst, has been experimenting. She joins us in the studio.
Hi, Robin.
Quick bread.
Quick bread. So traditional bread is made with yeast. And
that thing you have to grow like a biology experiment.
Yes, there you go. You know, it's involved. It's a wonderful process, but not necessarily one that most of us have a lot of time for. So these are called quick breads because they do not involve any yeast. The leavening agents in quick breads are baking powder and baking soda, zucchini bread, banana bread, lemon bread, gingerbread, and then I've gone in savory directions with this.
Well, let's launch in right there because this beauty here, and we'll have pictures and recipes at herenow.org, looks to be some sort of cheese and herb bread.
Very good. Exactly what it is. I thought, why can't these breads be savory? You always see them with fruits and vegetables. So what I did was I followed essentially the basic recipe, which I have to say, all these breads are so simple. You often make them in one bowl, sometimes two. You can use a mixer or not. This is a cheese and herb bread. It's very light because it's made with buttermilk. And if you don't have buttermilk, add about a tablespoon of lemon juice to a cup of milk and let it sit for a minute, and that's a substitute. It uses ricotta cheese, Parmesan cheese, and I have fresh parsley in there, fresh chives, rosemary, and thyme. This is a bread that's delicious on its own, but toasted it with a tomato sandwich in the summertime or using it as the base of a grilled cheese sandwich would be incredible.
Oh, my God, you're killing me. Okay, let's go to the – it's a banana bread.
It is a banana bread, and I baked a whole banana into it, so I made the batter.
I just have to inject. I once made banana bread for a guy, and he thought I was trying to kill him because he saw the bananas and –
oh, the rotten
how
bananas.
How dark they get.
It's true. This is the time and the place for those blackened, somewhat rotted but not moldy bananas. You want to mash them up. I like to save one good banana and cut it down lengthwise. And after I make the batter, I put a whole half banana onto the batter and bake it. And it's very beautiful.
A fresher one.
Yes, yeah, okay. Not one that's falling apart.
Okay.
And I also added crystallized ginger and ground nutmeg and some almond flour. So it's not just your ordinary banana bread. It's quite moist, and the ginger gives it a lovely little zip. Okay. And that you can eat on its own. You could put butter on it. It would be delicious for breakfast, tea time, coffee.
Tea time.
You get the ginger in there?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's really, I like that a lot.
Okay, that is good. All right. But dessert, bread for dessert.
Dessert, imagine that. So this is a double chocolate bread. This recipe is an adaptation of one that appeared in a book I wrote 20 years ago called Leftovers. And this is like a dessert-like bread, but it's not cake. And it uses cocoa powder, and it also uses semi-sweet or bittersweet chocolate. Mm. And it is quite dark. It almost looks like rye bread, but it's the double chocolate. And you sift the cocoa in with the flour and the baking powder and the baking soda. You cream some sugar and eggs and butter. And then I add sour cream to keep it really, really moist and throw in some chopped chocolate. Again, really, really simple, great breads to make to bring to a party or you're spending the weekend with friends. They make wonderful gifts. Yeah.
Well, you know, I'm thinking that they don't really feel like breads. I mean, in some ways, you know, banana bread does feel more cakey. But this, the savory, the cheese, when you said tomato sandwich, with this, how
can't you just imagine it?
Yeah.
I know. And that I agree with you. The cheese and herb bread is the most bread-like.
Right.
But can I tell you for a minute the difference? So we've talked about yeast being what you use for a traditional bread, but these use baking powder and baking soda. And I did a little research because I have always been confused. Which is which? What does it do?
Which one you put in the back of the refrigerator to pick up
exactly,
odors?
Right? So they're both chemical leaveners, meaning they generate gas when they're being mixed and baked into a batter, and it causes the batter to rise and aerate. But baking soda is another name for sodium bicarbonate. And when sodium bicarbonate or baking soda comes into contact with a liquid and an acid, so many of these recipes use buttermilk or a little bit of yogurt or sour cream, it produces carbon dioxide gas, and the bubbles produce the rise that you're looking for. Now, baking powder is also made of bicarbonate of soda, but it's with a powdered acid. It's often cream of tartar. And when you add baking powder, all it needs is moisture to cause the rise. It doesn't need the acid component. So often you'll see baking powders called double acting, and it's got a two-part reaction. The first part occurs the minute it's dissolved into your batter, and the second occurs slowly when it's being baked. So these are two things that you want to have on hand all the time, because what it means is that you can put together a quick bread, instant, no sitting around for yeast, no science experiments.
It's fabulous. We'll have, again, all the recipes at HereAndNow.org. You look like a genius. Kathy Gunst, Here and Now Chef, thank you.
Thanks, Robin.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm hungry. Oh, I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now.